You're listening to Last Word Soccer Club Radio. Only here, lastwordonsports.com.
What's up, Internet? My name is Matt Pollard, and you are listening to Last Word Soccer Club Radio, only here, lastwordonsports.com. We are brought to you by Icarus FC and Roughneck Scarves, and are a part of the Beautiful Game Network. It is Friday, February 26, 2021. The She Believes Cup has come to completion. We have gotten some recent and significant financially implied MLS news that has dropped in the last days, and in one case, in the last several hours. And here to talk about all of that with me is Rachel Krieger. Rachel, how is your week?
This week is good. It's our favorite word, more your favorite word, chaotic. It is very chaotic. I have this final paper due for school on Saturday. I just plugged away at it today, and I'm like, I'm overthinking it, and I'm overthinking it too much, but I'll get there. It'll be fine. But I have to tell you, it's very short, so go with me on this. I'm in a pickle. So my friend and I have what we're doing this year is a fish fry tour. As you know, the rule for us Catholics is abstain from meat on Fridays during Lent. And so we're doing a fish fry tour. And so for the last couple weeks building up to it, I have a friend who is a priest over at a neighboring church. And he was like, you got to come to our fish fry. Like, we got the best fish. Like, it's top class fish, right? And so I go today. My friend didn't join me today. She went to go visit her family. And the fish was so bad. And I don't know how to break it to him that the fish was so, like, it wasn't good. I don't know if it was what they did with the bread. I don't know if you're a fish guy, Matt, but, like, I don't know if it was something they did with the breading, but it just, like, was not my cup of tea. And I don't know how to break it to my friend Father Tim that the fish at Assumption was not that great.
I'm a vegetarian right now, Rachel, so I'm not the person to ask. However, my mom is from the northern part of the Lower Peninsula of Michigan. So if you pull out your map here, folks, kind of in the middle-ish part in, like, Otsego County, and I have heard this from a lot of locals, Rachel. I have not been able to confirm this, but supposedly, like, one of the big marketing head honchos was traveling through on, like, a business road trip in the Upper Peninsula and in the northern half of the Lower Peninsula, where whitefish and cod and just fishing both from the local lakes and the local rivers, and then obviously the Great Lakes, Michigan, Huron, and Superior in the case of the UP, and found the fish fry to be really interesting, and supposedly that was the inspiration for the Filet-O-Fish. But if there was nothing wrong with the actual fish taste itself, the most complicated thing that you have going on is the actually applying and then the cooking of the battered fry part on the outside. So my guess would be there's something in that process, either in the ingredients, how it's being applied, that's become problematic. I don't know if that helps you at all, but that's most likely the quality of the ingredients or the actual fish preparation itself. It's getting the batter on and then making sure that fries properly. That could be the most problematic thing that turns a good fish fry into a very freaky Friday.
Leave it to you to have a legitimate explanation, Matt, honestly.
Yes. Okay. But let's get into things that people actually want to hear about, Rachel. And we will start, albeit with a little bit of old news now, but there was actual soccer being played actually in the United States that had competitive and international implications over the course of the past 2 weeks. And that was, of course, the She Believes Cup, of which, Rachel, the United States women's national team were once again victorious with a perfect record, 9-4, 0 conceded, and then ultimately 9 in their 3 wins. Relatively, once we'll get into the Canada game itself and the microcosm of little moments there that caused that result, Rachel, but certainly a comprehensive victory for the U.S. over Brazil. And then obviously they had the final game of the tournament against Argentina, the weakest team of the group. They were in there for various reasons that we can get into, Rachel. But in any case, they only needed a draw, and they ended up getting a 6-0 win. So overall, job done. Some progress made in terms of just the women's national team actually getting some competitive games against good competition. And then overall, just, you know, more opportunities for playing time for players and tactical implementation for Vlachan Mandanovsky ahead of what will obviously be the biggest tournament of his young managerial career with women's national team, with the Olympics coming on this summer. Rachel, your thoughts generally on the tournament and any of the points that I brought in? We'll talk about individual games in a few minutes.
Yeah, so one of the things that I guess kind of just starting from the beginning was when, you know, it was decided that Japan was going to pull out because of COVID concerns, and Argentina was coming in. And then, you know, news kind of broke from the Canadian Federation that Ashley Lawrence, Kadesha Buchanan, Christine Sinclair, and Jordan Hoytema, just to name a few players, weren't going to be on the She Believes Cup roster. A lot of people were like, oh my gosh, like this is, you know, the U.S. is just going to cruise by, and they're like, the only meaningful competition they're going to have is Brazil. But I mean, just generally, I was really impressed with Canada. I feel like every year I kind of hype up Brazil so much because they have Marta, they have Dabinha, they have, Barbara, all these ridiculously good players. And they're in the process as well with former U.S. women's national team manager, Pia Sundhage. Of bringing in kind of like a new wave of Brazilians. I mean, who can forget Marta's speech after losing to France at the World Cup, where she said, you know, there's not going to be a Marta forever. There's not going to be a Cristiani forever, a Formiga forever. So they're kind of bringing in their new wave. So, I mean, for the most part, to get the games is great because you need to have those touches. You need, especially for Vlatko, to kind of figure out who is he going to bring to the Olympics, who is he not? And Matt, I don't know if you saw, but the allocation list came out for the NWSL, for the U.S. soccer contracts, and now that's kind of gonna help, you know, kind of navigate those waters. But also, you still have those players that are in Europe that are still in contention. But anyway, I thought the tournament was good. You know, there was a couple COVID situations with Argentina, but kudos to the Argentinians because they got everything under control. They pretty much followed every protocol. They just had a couple little cases pop up here and there. And I think the majority of it was like coming into the U.S. So probably got picked up somewhere in Argentina. But I thought it was a really good tournament. I think that Vlatko Andonovsky is going to have a lot of tough decisions to make. And there are still a lot of players for me that weren't on this She Believes Cup roster that either should get a good look or are definitely going to get a good look. So, and it was great to see, you know, Katerina Macario get more games and more time. She left ahead of the Argentina game. It was agreed upon before with, Lyon that she would go back to Lyon, just because of, you know, French quarantining policy and procedure. You know, Lyon didn't want her to miss too much time. But I thought it was a good tournament. I thought the U.S. got some good competition, good meaningful competition. And if you would have told me that the tighter game was going to be with Canada over Brazil, I would have told you were crazy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, good points then there, Rachel. Particularly, I know, for those of you who don't know, Smoke, certainly when we think about the stature and the history and the competitiveness of the men's national team in Argentina, the women's national team certainly has a lot more to catch up in that regard. And certainly them being brought in last minute into this tournament was not ideal for their performance. So not surprised and not even really disappointed, because I would have expected them to not be successful in their three games, especially against the United States, at which point they didn't have anything to play for in the context of the tournament. But Rachel, Brazil's been an interesting one for me. You know, I thought they had a really good tournament, but they're in a similar, you know, I think about the Brazil women's national team, both historically and where they are right now. You know, Marta and some of the other big stars that they have, notwithstanding, they're a group that, you know, if a women's World Cup, COVID notwithstanding, normalcy reestablished in this fictional, you know, thought experiment I have, toss them into any other group other than the assumed group of death of that Women's World Cup. I would expect them to get out of the group. I would expect them to maybe not comfortably get past the round of 16. And then at that point, they're playing teams that have a better history, more depth, better tactical awareness. And then at that point, they would lose. So kind of their performance in the 2019 Women's World Cup, losing when they did to who they did, made sense to me in terms of where they're at. And so I think about the U.S. and the upper echelon of a couple of other teams. And I think about Brazil, again, filtering out with Marta being 35. And, you know, beyond this Olympics, who knows what her women's national team career looks like starting in 2022, of a group that can comfortably be competitive, but when they play a superior team, absolutely will lose. And so I think about and I look at them comfortably beating Argentina, as I would have expected. For my money, surprisingly, or I was impressed by their victory over Canada, and even though they lost 2-0 to the United States, didn't look super terrible relative to where they were in 2019. For me, feels like progress to where now this is a team that if you told me right now they were to make it to the semifinals of the Olympics, depending on who they played in the quarterfinals, I wouldn't be super surprised. Is this Brazil team better? Are they making progress? Did they just have a good game against Canada? Where is Brazil in terms of the hierarchy tiers of women's soccer going into this coming tournament this summer?
I think bringing in Pia Sundhage really changes things for Brazil. And that's nothing against Veado, who was their manager, I think, for like 5 or 6 years. He actually just, he passed away last year, I think at the end of the summer. He was already, you know, Pia Sundhage was already in the position, but, you know, anyway. I think her bringing in this young wave of talent, because she's doing what she did with the U.S. She's bringing in a new young wave of talent. She's, you know, incorporating it with those veteran players, because Marta's not ready to walk away. Neither is Cristiani and neither is Barbara. And I think that was showcased at the She Believes Cup, because Marta started pretty much every game. Cristiani got into the games. She got good minutes and she was productive. Formiga is still a player who is still in contention to be on this roster. And she's what, 44, I think. She's in her 40s, but definitely fact check me on that one. Cause she was the oldest player. She was the player last year at the World Cup who was in every single World Cup. I think Brazil, yeah, they had a good game against Canada. I was surprised they didn't have as good of a game as the United States. But my thing with Brazil has always been this. If you would ask me right now, even with as many titles and accolades and stuff the U.S. women's national team has, who the best two goal scorers in the world are, one and two in order are Christine Sinclair and Marta. And the problem with both Canada and Brazil is there's so much talent when it comes to those two players, but the rest of the roster is kind of lacking. And that's not knocking on the players. They do a great job, but there's only so much that, you know, they can do. It's the Marta show. It's the Sinclair show. It was put on display during the She Believes Cup. Canada had a heck of a hard time scoring goals. I mean, it was pretty lackluster. Argentina gave them a run for their money, and I don't think anybody expected that. But I think Brazil is on the right path, and I think that hiring Pia was probably their best choice. I mean, they had a lot of people to pick from, and I think she was obviously the best choice. She's a proven winner. She knows how to work a roster. She knows how to and she knows how to, like, kind of integrate a roster. It's not just, okay, well, we're just going to push out all these players. Like, she's basically giving the team to, like, Dabinia and Barbara and telling Marta and, like, Cristiani, like, you're still part of the process. And then bringing in these new players. I think it's definitely a step in the right direction. And every year, I say it every year during the World Cup, if anybody wins, aside from the United States, I want it to be Brazil. I want it to be Brazil. And I just feel like Marta, like, is owed a World Cup at this point because of how great she is. But just the talent around her hasn't quite added up to where she's at. But I think it's on the right path.
let's get to the other team that was potentially going to be a dark horse relative to the United States. I think the biggest game, both historically and in terms of status in this tournament, was the opening game between the United States and Canada. Rachel, Rose Lavelle with the only one, my girl getting it in the 79th minute. Was Canada screwed in this game? Should this game have turned out differently?
The funny thing about the Sheva Leaves Cup was Canada got hosed in the first game. And then the exact same way that Canada got hosed, Argentina got hosed when they played Canada in the second game. So it was, I understand that there's no VAR, but when a person is like moving their arm to get the ball, then that's a handball. It's very simple. Like, I mean, I love Midge Purse. I think she's a great defender, although she should be in the attack. But that's another rant for another day. It was a clear and obvious handball. And then I don't remember who had the handball for Canada against Argentina. But it was kind of funny because it just negated it. But yeah, Canada played really well against the United States. And everybody was like, I remember because I was talking to Jeff from Equalizer about it before the game came on. He was like, get ready because Canada's going to get hosed. And I said, I don't know, buddy, but without all of their stars, Canada really, really matched up well against, and the United States rolled out their, you know, starting 11. So it was definitely heartbreaking, I'm sure, for Canadians to lose in that manner. But I mean, let's not take anything from Rose Lavelle. She's just so good at scoring goals. I wish she would do it a little bit more at the club level.
Let's get into what this means for the Olympics for the United States, Rachel. I have a little bit of a rant. I've been feeling this for a while, and I feel like this kind of confirms it to an extent. I'm concerned with the age, and in the case of the second player, recent injury between Megan Rapinoe and Tobin Heath. For the front for the women's national team. I think Kristen Press can be a great striker, but I don't know that. I'm concerned that the U.S. women's national team, when all else is going wrong in the Olympics this summer, do not have a player that is just pass the ball to them and they will create something that can get us through a very difficult game. 8-9 years ago, that player was Abby Wambach. At the 2015 World Cup, that player, albeit more from the midfield, was not Kristen Press. Who am I thinking of? Carly Lloyd, excuse me. And then to a lesser extent, Abby Wambach as well. And then in 2019, that was Megan Rapinoe. Megan Rapinoe played great for my money in this tournament, but again, where she is age-wise. Tobin Heath, age-wise, and recent injury. Kristen Press from, you know, not at that same elite echelon as the other players who I've mentioned previously, Rachel. And then also Alex Morgan, injury, baby, playing at Tottenham, coming back to the United States, also a little bit wobbly. There is time. There is plenty of time for these players to get healthy, to get back to being fit, regardless of what the 2021 NWSL season looks like, and obviously be in camp and be ready to ramp up. But 3 months out from the tournament, Rachel, I don't see an obvious that player is an attacking match winner if we need them in the ways that I have seen this team in previous tournaments in which they have, for the most part, comfortably won, lifted the trophy, or in the case of the Olympics, the gold medal. Rachel, am I crazy? Am I imagining things? Or do I have a valid concern in the back of my head?
I wanted that to be Lynn Williams so badly because she's so good at the club level. But every time she gets to the national team, it's like, I feel like she hesitates. Like she has chances and then she passes it, or she has chances and she completely like just, you know, skies it or whatever. I really wanted that player that you just described to be Lynn Williams. And I would love to say that it is Rose Lavelle, but Rose Lavelle is made of breadsticks. Like she gets hurt constantly, and that's not knocking her. It's just the truth. She gets hurt all the time. I think that's one of the reasons why Man City is so like hesitant to play her, because she gets hurt all the time. I'm with you there. I don't think that there is, if anyone I think could be that player, it would be Press, but it would be that like come off of the bench in like the 60th minute thing. Everyone, all of the Press stands are going to hoot and holler about how she should be starting. And maybe she should. I don't know. But I think she is a better off-the-bench super sub. She's somebody that's going to score like crazy when she comes off the bench. But, I mean, that's not saying just bench her every single game. You're definitely going to start her to, you know, do the rotation. Because those Olympic games are, like, smashed together. I know for the Tournament of Nations, they just announced, like, U.S. Women's National Team, like, their schedule for 2021, and they're doing a Tournament of Nations before, because it's usually in August, but like that's around when the Olympics are. So they're mimicking kind of the Olympic group stage schedule with the Tournament of Nations. I don't remember where I was going with that. Something about Kristen Press and how she in rotation. But anyway, I think Katarina Macario could be that player. I haven't seen enough of her. She did not impress me at all against Canada. I barely remember the Brazil game, but from what I remember, she was pretty much a non-factor. But I don't know. I feel like it's kind of like a Christian Pulisic thing where everybody is hyping her up so much. And then she gets there and it's just kind of like, okay, she played art. Like, she played fine, but, like, it wasn't, like, mind-blowing like we're used to seeing from Rapinoe's sudden burst in 2019 and whatnot. I think to tie into your rant, here's my rant. Some of these old players, they gotta go. Kelly O'Hara is made out of thinner breadsticks than Rose Lavelle. Constantly gets hurt. No idea why the Washington Spirit got her, whatever. There's so many other better defenders in the NWSL that play consistently. And this has been you've known me for 3 years now, and I've preached this for 3 years, Matt. If you don't play for club and you don't produce for club, you should not be on the national team. That's why I hate these stupid allocation federation contracts. Okay. Deep breath. Here we go. O'Hara should not be on the Olympic roster. She shouldn't be on any more U.S. women's national team rosters. Now, you can tell me I'm totally wrong if she goes and like lights it up with Washington, but I'll believe it when I see it. Other better defenders in the NWSL. Casey Kruger, formerly Casey Short, should be a starter with literally no hesitation on Vlatko Andonovski's part. I didn't watch the last game because I was coaching, but I saw the lineup and I saw Emily Sonnet starting over her, and I couldn't believe it. I was like, what are you doing starting Emily Sonnet, who to me, I don't think she's national team level. I hope she goes to Washington and kind of turns it around, but I just don't think she's national team level. And then you start her over Casey Kruger, whatever. I like the addition of Jalen Howell. I hope she goes to the Olympics. I don't think she's going to, because I think Sam Mewis will come back and take, you know, fill that role. But I like Jalen Howell. It's a nice look into the future. And I was very surprised she didn't declare for the draft. But also back to the, speaking of like recent draft picks and stuff like that, back to the defender thing, you know, you have Emily Fox, you have Alana Cook, these young players that can come in and make a big difference. You have Sarah Gordon, who has been a consistently good defender in the NWSL. Christy Mewis, who has finally unlocked her potential and lit it up last year. She has been getting a fair share and a fair shot with the U.S. Women's National Team, and she has produced, and she has produced very well. She is making a case for an Olympic spot, and I hope to God she gets it. She was just given a national team allocation contract, so fingers crossed. I'm hoping for her that she goes. But pretty much, yeah, I mean, it's an 18-player roster. If you ask me right now who were the 18 I would be taking, it would be completely different from the 18 that I know are going to probably get selected. But like Kelly O'Hara, Carly Lloyd, Megan Rapinoe, it's a no for me. And I'm not just saying this because I've had issues with their club performances. I don't think Allie Krieger and Ashlyn Harris should be going to the Olympics either. I think, you know, let the young guns take it. I could have done backflips when I saw Casey Murphy get put on the roster as a goalkeeper. in addition over Ashlyn Harris. And I know it's also, you know, you have to add in the factor of her and Allie Krieger just adopting their baby. I know the timing was weird with Sheva Lee's Cup, but Casey Murphy, I think she deserves it more because of her club play. And note to Vlatko Andonovski, we know that Alyssa Nayer is the starting goalkeeper. So can we see another goalkeeper play in for the U.S. Women's National Team? Because I personally would love to see that. Take it away, Matt.
Well, I've got a few more questions, Rachel. We'll do these a little bit rapid fire. First of all, Crystal Dunn, right now, the best or simply the best?
Simply the best and the best.
Okay. Post She Believes Cup, on a scale of 1 to 10, 10 being U.S. Women's National, being in a, if you had to bet all of the money in your banking account right now on the U.S. Women's National Team or the field, you would take the Women's National Team, and DEFCON 1 is the Olympics. They're losing and getting, park the bus totally nipped by Sweden. Where are you on a scale of 1 to 10, how you feel about the Olympics, taking into account the She Believes Cup?
I think the rest of the world is catching up. I would go like a five.
Okay. Now is that for you, Rachel, when you think about that, is that five being an average because it's in between, or like for seven, would you think of that as like a C and therefore passing, and thus five is not satisfactory?
I think five is just kind of like in the middle, unknown. I have no idea which way this tournament is going to go. If we even have this tournament, I don't know how it's going to go. I mean, I feel like the U.S. could just come in and like completely light it up. But at the same time, the rest of the world is catching up, and there is a good slew of teams going to the Olympics.
Last question, Rachel, the jersey leak from earlier this week, your thoughts?
Dan Sperry, I'm so sorry if you're listening. I hate it. It's so bad. One of my favorite kits was that 2014 kit that they wore for the men's World Cup. And that was like peak for me. That 2015 kit was also very good. And just like, it's been going downhill. The camo last year was so weird to me. I hated it. I'm not a stripes person, and I sent it to a friend, and she was like, I can't look at it for more than like a minute because I'm getting a headache. And it's too much for me. I do love the socks, though. I do love the socks.
All right, let us move on to the roundtable, Rachel, and we will start with the recent news shakeup at Club de Foot Montreal, and that is that Thierry Henry has chosen to step down just ahead of, you know, a couple weeks out from preseason starting for family reasons. We haven't gotten a lot of details, Rachel, as to whether or not this could potentially be COVID-related, but obviously Thierry was living and working in Montreal or wherever it was the impact were hauled up throughout the 2020 season. Obviously, his family was back in England. I believe he still lives somewhere in London proper, given all the time that he spent at Arsenal Football Club. So had gone, you know, for the better part of 10 months, maybe even a year without seeing his kids, and obviously that complication. So in any case, he tweeted out after this announcement on his Twitter page, at Thierry Henry. It is with a heavy heart that I'm writing this message. The last year has been an extremely difficult one for me personally. Due to the worldwide pandemic, I was unable to see my children. Unfortunately, due to the ongoing restrictions and the fact that we have to relocate to the U.S. again for several months at least, will be no different. Separation is too big of a strain for me and my kids. Therefore, it is with much sadness that I must take the decision to return to London and leave CF Montreal. I would like to thank the fans, players, and all the staff at the football club that have made me feel so welcome. I would also like to thank Kevin Gilmore, Olivier Rainier, and of course Joey, referring to Joey Saputo, the owner, and all the Saputo family for giving me this wonderful opportunity. We had an impossible year together, and to make the playoffs with this group of people is an experience that I will never forget. Thank you all for being there on this journey, and I wish you all success for the future. Rachel, we already know, with the exception of Toronto, who have the Amway Canadian Championship final against Forge, the other two Canadian teams will be having preseason south of the border and will likely, due to the international non-essential travel issue between the border of the U.S. and Canada, at the least for a little bit, that Montreal will effectively be in another bubble, complicating things further. And it's kind of uncertain what that would have looked like. Based on, if I'm reading between the lines, I would think if, MLS had come out and said, hey, everybody's starting in their own home market unless they want to do otherwise, to where Thierry could have been in Montreal and then presumably stable for that. Could have done this. So this seems like the details have been sussed out for preseason and the start of season, and I was already kind of at a breaking point, and this was the straw that broke the camel's back for a camel that obviously had a lot going on. At the same time, Rachel, this is a coach stepping down, you know, less than two months away from the season starting, weeks out from preseason, and they built this squad largely in what Thierry Henry wanted, and kind of the one constant that Montreal has had foot or impact in the last several years has been change and a revolving door at manager and at players and just uncertainty around the club that has just led to instability that has prevented this club from having stable success in MLS and, to quote Joey Saputo from the Reband, having an impact. Rachel, what does this mean for Montreal? Where do they go from here? And at this point, is this not sneakily Thierry trying to like just set himself up to easily step into the Bournemouth job?
Well, that is classified information. You pretty much just summed everything up, so you make my job easy as always, Matt. But I have a couple notes. I think with the timing, it looks bad, but you cannot fault the guy whatsoever for wanting to be with his family. I mean, I think it takes a big, it's a big decision. It takes a big person to, you know, put his family first before his career. So, all of the kudos in the world to Thierry Henry, and I hope he enjoys the time with his family. He did a lot of good things for Montreal. I think he really shook things up just with his presence, because Montreal was so conservative for the last couple of years. And then Thierry Henry, the Mr. Popular, comes in and he really shakes things up and he just, you know, makes it his own show. And I mean, I was looking so forward to seeing year number two with him. I really, really was. I have a hard time paying attention to the Eastern Conference because I pay more attention to the West. But I loved watching Montreal at MLS's back, and I enjoyed watching them play in the CCL competitions. I mean, they were, except for when they beat Seattle, of course. But it was great. I mean, I was really, really happy to see him coaching in MLS. He is also on my list of he's in my top five of best dressed MLS coaches. So I'm definitely going to miss his style as well. But it was nice to have a young, fresh face. And now, you know, we kind of have that with, Hernan Lozado over in DC United, which is exciting. But it kind of, you know, it takes away, almost kind of negates again, because Thierry Henry is gone. So, Montreal has some options. I think with the shortness of time, they're going to play it safe and pick somebody up that, you know, has a name that we know and is probably coached. Diego Alonso is still on the market, I think. Former Inter Miami boss. I think he could be a good option for them. I think if anything, you know, they might just bring somebody in who's like a year for them, and then they trial it, and then they're like, all right, let's see if we keep you. Let's see if we move into another direction. Just the timing kind of changes everything here. We went from having all of the MLS head coaching spots filled to now there's one more vacancy that nobody really saw coming. So, but kudos to him for, you know, going back to his family, and I hope he can coach somewhere over in England.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Other big announcement that we have related to an expansion team that is just even in the last couple of hours, Rachel. I'm looking at the press release from MLS, and it's listed at 7:46 p.m. Eastern. I'm recording this just after 10 p.m. East Coast time. And it's an announcement regarding the state of Sacramento's MLS expansion bid. And so announced today, earlier today, Ron Burkle informed the league that based on issues with the project related to COVID-19, he has decided to not move forward with the acquisition of an MLS expansion team in Sacramento. After working for many years to bring an MLS team to Sacramento, the league continues to believe that it can be a great MLS market. In the coming days, the league will move with Mayor Daryl Steinberg, as in Mayor of Sacramento, to evaluate current possible steps for MLS in Sacramento. Quote, I want to thank Mayor Steinberg for his continued effort to bring MLS to Sacramento, unquote, said MLS Commissioner Don Garber. Quote, his commitment to the city and delivering for its passionate soccer fans should make all citizens in Sacramento proud. Interest in owning a club in Major League Soccer has never been higher, and I remain incredibly optimistic about finalizing expansion plans for our 30th team. I don't know, Rachel, if implying our 30th team there, he's talking about Sacramento specifically, with Austin joining MLS officially on the field in 2021, then with Charlotte, St. Louis City, that makes 28, 29, Sacramento, which yet to have been renamed, that I would assume would just be knocking off the FC to Sacramento Republic, and changing the crest a little bit, would be club number 30. But in any case, Rachel, Sacramento came in and they had all the buzz. They were, I would argue, a super club in the USL Championship and continue to be one of the quality teams in there. Fantastic downtown rail yard stadium situation and the funding behind that. Kind of the one thing that they were missing for 3 or 4 years there was, you know, a billion-dollar-ish investor who could come in and then provide the main financial component for MLS. As we've seen with other expansion bids, I won't name names, but you probably know who I'm talking about, folks. MLS has shown if you have everything that we would want from a grassroots and an infrastructure and a staff standpoint, but not the money, we need the money. And if the only thing that you can guarantee us is a lot of the money, then we'll take a lot of the money. And so kind of the one big thing that was the only thing holding back Sacramento Republic for several years that they finally got, they now don't have again. And given the fickleness of how Don Garber and the MLS Expansion Committee has treated this, I would not be at all shocked if, like, this is the Achilles heel of this bid and they choose to, you know, I don't know what the language is and the legal implications here, Rachel, but technically it's Sacramento being the first ones to violate, or renege on the whatever contract, you know, legal agreement that had been decided upon, to whether or not they open it up to say, okay, Austin, you're in. Charlotte, St. Louis, you're still in. We're open to hearing from somebody else with Sacramento in doubt, and potentially, you know, Sacramento gets Wally pipped, and who knows if MLS decides to stop at 30 teams in any case. But this is a massive blow for Sacramento's expansion. The one big thing that they needed was somebody like Burkle coming in, and then it was full steam ahead. They checked all the boxes that you would want from an MLS expansion side, and now the one box, in many cases, based on precedent, the only box that often has mattered at times to MLS is now being unchecked again. And I don't know what this means for Sacramento, but believe you me, Rachel, if they decide to open up, if, you know, Don Garber decides to open up, we're interested in hearing from other people that, you know, we're going to get a lot more of the rounds of him coming and saying the usual spiel for cities and little events that he has and opening that up. And just in another way, Sacramento, a market deserving of first division soccer in the United States, getting shafted and having that taken away from them due to the bigger money politics implied in this. Speaking of money and politics, Rachel, and another MLS expansion team, there's Charlotte FC, and they've come out with some of the initial information that they have for season ticket holders for the start of their season in 2022. And Rachel, these ticket prices are damn expensive. They are damn expensive by even some of the more expensive MLS markets. And then Charlotte FC has even gone as far to pull what is a very NFL and in some cases NBA thing in having these one-time ticket seat license costs. that you have to pay just to get season tickets, and tacking that onto the already slightly overpriced season ticket cost, are making things really, really expensive, where outside of the supporters section, which you can still get for pretty typical prices compared to other MLS markets that are behind the goal and don't require a seat license, Rachel, you're looking at, for the cheapest per match ticket for season tickets, you're looking at $35, and you're looking at, if you're talking about $630 season ticket, assuming 17 matches, a seat license of $350. So just doing some rough math, $900, that gets you to post-tax, Rachel, probably $1,000 per seat. So for a family of four, how is that remotely plausible when you're dropping $4,000 just on the tickets themselves, to say nothing of the concession costs and everything? Rachel, there was a lot of buzz about this on Twitter, and certainly comparing it to other MLS markets and everything. And these are prices that would have outdone Atlanta United in 2017. And I've yet to see anything on the technical side that makes me believe that Charlotte FC are going to be MLS Cup contenders in 2022, let alone champions in 2023.
Oh, you just wait until they get the best manager in the world or something, and they bring like Jurgen Klinsmann or some crap into their, yeah, I don't even know. Nothing can justify this. I'm tired. It's late on the East Coast. These ticket prices are so bad, and it makes me grateful. And like, I know, like, yes, we're media, we get into the games, we really don't have any costs. But like, I'm so happy MLS is not in Pittsburgh, because I could see Pittsburgh pulling some stupid crap like this. But like, who would even think, like, you are already peeving off your fans before, first off, you peeved them off when you didn't pick Charlotte Town, so shame on you. And stupid Charlotte FC, so stupid. And now you're just peeving them off even more. Like, the thing that makes MLS so great, not to get like overly analytical about this, but like, it's such a, I feel like MLS is such a family thing. I don't know. Like, it's so, I always see like on the TVs and stuff, like families at the games. Like, I don't usually see that at NFL games. I see like, you know, guys and their buddies going, and like, whatever, you know, to each their own. But like, soccer is such a fun family thing. And like you said, like, these ticket prices are crazy. No family's going to pay $4,000 for season tickets for four people. That's just, that's crazy.
I don't know. I don't think there's anything else for us to say on that front, Rachel. Definitely sticker shock, not only the price of the tickets, but also just the seat license coming in that no other MLS team has. And you need to have that, you know, that's the, you know, money that you have to give up that's not refundable just to get the season ticket. Now you can transfer it back, but it's hiking up on the price even further. And so that's really disappointing. And I'm really curious to see now what that looks like in terms of, well, how big of a team are they building out? What's the marketing and the buzz around the team? Because yes, you know, Atlanta had a lot of buzz and they backed it up on the field. But I mean, if you're, this is going to look really bad and this could backfire really quickly if the team's terrible, if it's like an FC Cincinnati level launch. And then on top of that, like, you've got like 15,000 people in the stands. And this is where, you know, particularly I, Rachel, as someone who covers a team that, you know, plays in a soccer specific stadium that is sized appropriately for the market and the size of the fan base relatively, to where, you know, Seattle comes in, it's, oh, we're going to play at CenturyLink. Okay, you better have the, like, you know, 40,000 people at CenturyLink looks great. 30,000 is functional. But if you're not even selling out the lower bowl, that's a huge hit from a money standpoint, from an ops standpoint, and just from a marketing and visibility standpoint. Atlanta certainly filled that out to where at least it's the lower bowl and oftentimes most of the second tier and at times the entire stadium. We could say the same thing of Seattle as well. Chicago has aspired to do that in moving back to Soldier Field. But I mean, you know, let's be real. If the fire are crap again, if they're a dumpster fire to start the season and they're getting like, you know, 12 to 17,000 people there, which would have been great for them being at Bridgeview, like, there's going to be no atmosphere at Soldier Field. And with the ticket prices on top of the concerns I have about what they're doing on the technical side, it doesn't give me a lot of confidence that they're going to fill out most of the lower bowl at, is it Bank of America Stadium, I believe, in Charlotte, that they also share with the Panthers? I believe that's correct.
Yeah, Bank of America.
Thank you. So let's move on. Rachel, last roundtable item we have. It is officially the start of jersey season, with MLS teams, having their jersey new kits for 2021 leaked and then also releasing them. Rachel, we're not going to take into account any of the ones that have supposedly been leaked or rumored on the free Twitter machine. But in any case, of the ones that we've seen that clubs has officially released, what do you think so far? And do you have a favorite?
I do. And I was telling you beforehand, I don't know if it's just me liking, you know, simple is best, but like, to me, simple is best. I'm not crazy about like super off the wall designs. Like, I feel like if a team has a crest and has a color scheme, you should usually stick with that. But I do like the galaxies. I will say that. It seems kind of plain, I guess, to some people. But I really think Nashville's looks very sleek. Their new blue, I think the yellow looks good on it. They have like faint like navy blue on navy blue kind of like slashes almost like towards the top. And then Minnesota United just dropped their new kit tonight. They call it like, it's like ice blue, and it's very fitting for them being up in Minnesota. And I think that the blue just looks really, really good. And not gonna lie, you know, I picked Atlanta's before we got on, and I do like the thin, I guess, the thin red lines, the five red stripes. Five red lines going down the red stripes. So I think for the most part, it's pretty good. I'm anxiously awaiting what Seattle does. That's all I can say.
Yeah, I kind of like, you know, it's, you know, the teams have all kind of come out, Rachel, and they've kind of had their own, like, name for it. Like, I think the Atlanta one that you're referring to has the five thin red stripes in kind of the middle of a mostly black jersey, and they call it the black, but then the A in the word black is actually turned into capital V or the Roman numeral for five, which is fun little there. Similar with Minnesota, and then obviously the community kit referring to kind of the it's more a call for the, in the case of the LA Galaxy, is more reference to like the state of the club and like their culture at the time with, you know, the updated version of their, black and green vertical stripes. And then obviously with the gold accent. So, I mean, it has to be that one, Rachel. It's one of the best jerseys of MLS 1.0 as far as I'm concerned. It's one of the best LA Galaxy jerseys of all time. And for them to bring it in and then nail it with the update and everything. And then on top of that, having the black shorts. And I don't know if you've seen, look at the socks here, Rachel, because there's the green and the black and then the gold quasar are absolutely fantastic. Normally, my first question from a jersey snob standpoint is there's kind of a couple different fashion views that I have. How is this going to look from a zoomed out version? And so, you know, from the top level of the first tier of any MLS stadium, how's it going to look on the field? How's it going to look on the wide shot? And then how does it look close up? And those can be different, and I can like the jersey in one of those and overall like the jersey even if in the other frame it doesn't look great. And then the second question that I have, if I'm buying it, does it work with jeans and my Copas at the soccer bar? And then does it work as the whole kit, even though I don't often go full kit W when it comes to soccer jerseys? But this, on a full kit W level, absolutely nailed it. It's fantastic. It's a great call to their heritage. And so the fact that, you know, it's kind of easy, Rachel, for an MLS team to go crazy with their secondary kit when their primary kit is mostly white. And given the trend that we've seen of the white secondary kits of, yeah, but we have the sash and the sash is our thing, then we can go crazy with the secondary kit where, you know, it's kind of the marketing when it's the primary kit, Rachel, or one that's unique and stands out color-wise to everybody else in MLS is easy to kind of have a cool nickname and then a reason behind the symbology of the kit. It's really, really hard to pull that off when the Colorado Rapids say, oh, it's the Black Diamond kit because it's white like snow, when eight other MLS teams are dropping an all-white kit, and your Black Diamond kit doesn't have any black on it. But I digress in that regard. Rachel, let's get to last words. Do you have any last words? And then feel free to tell our dear listeners about Icarus FC.
Not too many last words. Just I cannot believe that it's been a year since, I know it's a topic that, you know, you care about being from Los Angeles, but I can't believe it's been a year since Kobe Bryant has passed. I know I'm a little bit late on this one. I haven't been on the pod for a while. But it just, it makes me very emotional, especially like the timing he passed away. It's peak basketball season for us. Seventh year now as a coach, first year as a head coach. It's a work in progress with my teams, but we're getting there. But I always just try to tell them, like, you know, have that Mamba mentality, you know, never give up in these games. And, you know, I mean, my kids the other night, just to kind of shed some light on it, we lost our game 37-6, I think. It was a rough night, and they just didn't give up. They were running up and down the whole time, and I was so proud of them. And I say my kids, I do not have children, people. They are like my children that I coach are my children. So yeah, just always have that Mamba mentality. So I'm proud of them. But Matt, are you tired of the same old uniforms and cookie cutter templates from Nike and Adidas? Are you
so tired?
Yes. Are you looking for a unique, completely custom kit for your youth club, Sunday league squad, adult, or even pro team? Icarus FC can help you create the kit of your dreams at an affordable price with the motto, any design you want. Seriously, let them help you design your new custom kit today at IcarusFC.com.
My last word, Rachel, there was a big interview that Zlatan Ibrahimovic did. I don't know when he did it, but a lot of the contents of it was dropped over the course of the last couple days. And in one of those, he was asked about the kind of American athlete culture of activism, particularly that we've seen in the last 12 years in the case of I think he was specifically asked about LeBron and kind of him being one of the leaders of the, you know, Black Lives Matter movement that we've seen in the NBA. And kind of his comments were effectively siding with Stick to Sports and telling them, like, stick to whatever you're good at professionally. You know, I'm a professional footballer, so I stick to football. LeBron is a basketball player. He should stick to basketball. If you want to get into politics, go be a politician. I don't talk about politics because I would be a terrible politician. And so where I can understand an individual deciding that that's not right for them, that they don't want to kind of wade into those waters. I find it, especially given Zlatan's run-ins, both in MLS and since MLS, you know, with the recent Milan derby and the scuffle that he had with Romelu Lukaku, a black player for Inter Milan. You know, he's had scuffles with players of color in the past, and there have been insinuations of why it's always black players, you know, whether it's that kind of change in him commenting on threatening violence towards Nathan Onuoha with, Real Salt Lake, when he was in MLS. And then obviously a little bit of a, I don't know, choke grab slash like grapple. The thing that he did with Sean Johnson that got him a yellow card that also got him suspended. Again, another black player. So I have a hard time seeing really any white person, let alone a white person in a position of privilege and authority and having a platform and lots of money, telling another black person to, like, shut up about your activism about institutionalized racism that even I can't comprehend as a white person. That does not sit well with me, as a person, whether it's as an LA Galaxy person, as someone who rooted for and covered and appreciated what Zlatan brought, who likes the kind of character and the aura, of Zlatan, and that coming out in a way that is negative. I wouldn't begrudge him if he said, you know, I'm not in a position of authority to where I can speak about this, so I'm not going to speak about that. And, you know, I could understand LeBron, like, not being a civil engineer, not, you know, commenting with extreme detail about the infrastructure bill. I have a hard time with a lot of people who have a platform due to their celebrity status who aren't super informed about certain issues, like trying to voice their opinions really from a position of ignorance, but just because they have a bigger megaphone are able to get that out. But I think LeBron's well versed in, you know, growing up in his life situation on poverty and what life is like for a lot of people, particularly ethnic minorities in Akron, Ohio and around the world, and just being a black man in a world that is still wrought with white power in a lot of situations. And even though he may not have been subject to that personally, being in a position to where he can relate to the situation that George Floyd and all of the other names that unfortunately we know too well about. And so I can understand, you know, like LeBron doesn't have a full understanding of like the gun legislation and like the gun economy in the country to comment on specifically what needs to be done to end gun violence. But, you know, most of what LeBron and other black people and people who Zlatan was subtweeting, that was basically just saying, you're not a politician, so don't talk about institutionalized racism and the policy that can actually deal with that, even though you're all black and are subject to institutionalized racism. Disappointing to hear from Zlatan in that particular instance. And so I guess in the spirit of his own comments, Rachel, I would suggest to Zlatan in the next couple of weeks, given how things have gone for Milan in club or in their domestic play and then in international play, then maybe Zlatan should just shut up and dribble. I want to thank our other sponsor, Roughneck Scarves. They are an official scarf supplier of MLS, USL, and US soccer merchandise. They also have non-N95, like just your regular cloth masks. They also have neck gaiters, and it is still very cold for certain parts of the country, like Pittsburgh and Denver, Colorado. They have generic kind of color design options. They have ones that are team and club-specific licensed soccer ones, and then all of that can be customizable as well. So get your custom all of that for your group, team, or office at Roughneck Scarves. Scarves.com. Listeners, follow me on Twitter at LWSMattPollard. Follow us across all social media platforms at LastWordSC. And check us out at LastWordOnSports.com/soccer all season long. Rate, review, share, subscribe, unsubscribe wherever you get your podcast. Just search LWS Radio or Last Word on Sports. You'll find us and a bunch of other great content. Listeners, have a great weekend. We'll see you next time.